boys and girls. This is the Ergonomics Radio Association Technical Net. Anybody who has a question, who is licensed to operate in the 2-meter band, is more than welcome to participate in this net. You don't have to be a club member. And, you know, as I say, you only have to be licensed to operate in the 2-meter band to participate. My station call is W2TTT. My name is Gordon. And this is K2BAR, or K2 Bravo Alpha Romeo, or Bergen Amateur Radio, if you will, the station of the Bergen Amateur Radio Association. The technical net is run weekly on Thursday nights at 9 p.m., and it's for the purpose of discussing anything related to wireless telecommunications or communications and electronic arts in general, whether or not it has to do with the technology or the application of the technology or just having fun with it, heaven forbid. It's all fair game. Have the God-given blessing of time and talent of each other, and we're here to share it. So we encourage everybody to check in, even if you don't have a question or a comment for the net. In any case, the Bergen Amateur Radio Association also runs a couple other activities during the week and month. Every week, on Monday, we are on 28.350 megahertz. We have a chat net on 10 meters at 9 o'clock. On Tuesday, we have it on, I think, at 444-100. I said 443-100, but no one ever corrects me. So one of them there things, the one in Hackensack, that repeater, and that's also 9 o'clock, and that's a nice, friendly chat net. We have one on this repeater on Wednesday night, again at 9 o'clock, and that's always nice as well. Format of this net is a little different. We're going to ask you to check in with your call sign, your name, and whether or not you have a question or a comment. Just say question, comment, or none. And we'll proceed from there. The way we're going to do this is in an orderly fashion, or as orderly as it can be. We will ask for W's first. Stations for call sign beginning with W, please call K2BAR with your call sign, your name, whether or not you have a question or comment or not.
This is WI2W. Steve, no question.
WE2R with a question.
WITW, Steve, no comments or questions, good. WE2R, Charlie, good evening to you. You have a question, so good evening to you and Steve. Any other whiskey stations, please call KWBAR. Okay, any November stations, please call KWBAR. Call sign, name, and whether you have a question, comment, or not.
NJ1W, Dave, no questions.
CRT, are you there?
3 CRT Mobile, no questions, and the name is Charlie.
Okay, good to you, and good to you, Dave, as well. Thank you very much, both of you. I was wondering, do we have a KD sighting, too?
He doesn't have a radio on your car.
Ah, okay. Oh, you're carpooling. Oh, my. Alrighty. Anybody else with November calls, please call K2BAR. Was it N2ZZK, I think. Name, please? Yeah, not getting that. You're a little on the noisy side. Okay, any other November stations, please call K2BAR. Any Alpha stations, please call K2BAR. Okay, Kilo stations of all forms and flavors, please call K2BAR with your call sign, your name, and whether or not you have a question, comment, or not.
K2BAR, KC2BYB, Richard, no question.
To what name?
Okay, KC2PYB Richard, got you. Good evening to you. Who's the station said they were listening?
H2ORX, board up. Hey, Robert.
Okay. You have a question, comment for the net?
Just listen, Senator. If I got a question or comment, come on here.
No problem. Anybody else with a kilo call, please call K2BAR.
K2ZO. Jim, no question.
Listening, no question.
Okay, I got Jim, no questions. Who was the second one with no questions?
This is KC2SQP Stewart, no questions.
Hi, Stewart. Okay, no problem. Good evening to you and Jim. Anybody else?
Sierra Wireless,
wide open. And by the way, Charlie, there are hacks to open that feature in a variety of places. So go look up your model number or your phone or Verizon phone hacks as a Google search.
Well, I'm paying the $10 a month for it, and so far it's helped me out so many times. It's well worth the money. So I'm pleased. I'm just amazed that, because I know with my boat GPS, you know, it's a big bulky thing, and, you know, it goes through this acquiring satellite thing, and the phone just seems, well, you just enable it, and in a few seconds it works. Anyway, I'm happy with it. I was just curious as to how this mysterious little box worked, WE2R.
Okay, well, as I said, there's plenty of hacks you can do for those things. They do exist. And, you know, it's your phone. You can use it any way you like as long as you don't use it to deceive somebody. There's nothing illegal about doing, you know, what you want with your phone. Just don't get into what I call a theft of services mode. But I reiterate, it's your phone. And there's lots of stuff you can do with it. Let's see what else. That's pretty much all I have here on that subject. I do one more point. Now I think about it. Let's keep in mind that your boat GPS is also designed probably to also use Lorian in conjunction with it or other goodies. And, oh, by the way, it's got to be, you know, impervious to water, notably salt water. It's got to be visible in bright sunlight. It's got to function in thermal extremes. So, you know, your phone doesn't have to work in any of those scenarios. So, you know, consider all that.
Yeah, okay, true. You know, the boat one is a far more durable, useful, versatile device. No question about it.
Okay, very good. Well, does anybody else have any questions, comments on the subject? We might have tickled them up a little bit. This is K2BAR.
N3CRT with a question, kind of comment.
Catch your eye.
I might have missed this when I transferred from my car to inside, but didn't a couple years ago, maybe the FCC, didn't they make it mandatory that the phones now have a GPS for, like, 911 call location or whatever? I'm not sure exactly if that's true or not, but don't most of them have a feature built in?
I believe more and more you're seeing that feature built in. I don't know the regulatory status.
All right, just wondering.
Okay, very good. That was interesting, to say the least. Anything else from anybody else? This is K2BAR.
Yeah, that's good, man.
Good, Jim.
What did I miss?
Question regarding whether or not there really was a GPS receiver in Charlie's Verizon cell phone. Answer, yes. Especially if you're paying for the service and seeing the results.
Yeah, I think a lot more have GPS receivers in them than have any kind of display system or, you know, linked for on a customer level. So, what is this guy doing? They're trying to kill me here. NS2K.
Okay, we're good with that. I'm just teasing. Okay. Alrighty. Any other comments, questions, confusions regarding GPS? This is K2BAR. Alrighty. Having covered that, any additional check-ins for the net, please call K2BAR.
K2BAR, K2FAZ.
K2FAZ, good evening. K2BAR, go ahead.
Just checking. checking in. Things are going. I mentioned, I think on the 10-meter net on Monday that I got the antenna up, and I'm going to try to find somebody, one of you guys has an antenna analyzer and can come check it out one of these days. Try to get my SWRs down a little bit.
I have one, Jim has one, the other Jim has something, other Gizmachi to make it work. Probably several other people do too. I'd be more than happy to come over anytime, Tony. Good evening to you. It was good hearing you on the net. What is your SWR without the tuner engaged, you know?
Well, I'll use some real technical lingo at first. At first, it was doing all kinds of funky stuff, jumping around. I don't know if the connector, the PL on the back of the LDG tuner was a little loose, but it doesn't seem to be jumping anymore. But my SWRs, I measured where when that was happening, so I have to redo it, and I haven't done it since. But they're not bad. On Monday night, was after I think I fixed whatever it was initially, the SWRs at on the 10-meter were, I think, straight on 1.5. You know, obviously, it could get a little better, but it's great.
Okay. Good. So, you're pretty close to this. I know, but these radios are really touchy about folding back. The SWR is not like totally, you know, 1.0, 1.1. They just don't behave well. So, that's kind of annoying at best. Anyway. Oh, that's very cool. Alrighty. Anything else that you'd like to discuss?
No, that's it for now. I'll give it back to net control. K2FZ.
Any other, anybody have comments for Tony on the subject, please call K2BAR. Okie doke. Well, any additional check-ins for the map, please call K2BAR. Alrighty. Well, I guess anybody have any additional questions for the map? This is K2BAR.
F3CRT with a comment.
Go ahead, Charlie.
Yeah, this is F3CRT. Launch date has been confirmed for the Delphi C3 satellite and some other CubeSats that will have amateur radio packages in them, and they're launching from India, and the launch date is about 4 days and 2 hours from now. So it's coming up pretty quick. You can check out their website at www.delphi, spelled D-E-L-F-I-C-3, D-E-L-F-I-C-3.nl. And that's one of the bigger kind of exciting packages that's going up. And you can go on there and you can sign up to be a telemetry downlinker. And if you've got the capabilities to do, you just leave your radio running and give a listen, and it'll decode telemetry and send it in. It'll automatically send it in, so that should be interesting. They're looking for amateur stations to record telemetry and submit their reports, and after, I think, 3 months, they'll turn it over to us. There's some experimentation that they're using the satellite for, and after that, it becomes a solely amateur radio-related transponder in the sky, so that's pretty cool of them. And you just check out the website. You can sign up for an account for telemetry, and it should be good and exciting for everybody. N3CRT.
K2GCL repeater.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I'm reading through what some of their experimental stuff is. It's very cool. Very cool. They have a little section for ham radio stuff too, but I was just looking at the scientific stuff. Pretty cool. Alrighty. So it's www.delfic3.nl, as in Nederland. Okey-doke. Alrighty. So, so 4 days and some number of hours later, we're going to see this up. You can register to be a telemetry person. That's very cool as well. You have the right stuff. My guess is it's probably a computer with a sound card, something like that. Anyway, we'll find out. This telemetry download decoding software, it's on the right side. It's right there on the main page. It's not hard to go find. Alrighty. Any other questions, comments, confusions on this subject or other satellite-related subjects, please call K2BAR. Any additional check-ins, please call K2BAR. Okay. Well, let me give you a little lesson. I learned a couple of things yesterday. One, when your coax has a problem, or your antenna has a problem at the end of the coax, I'm not sure which, Chuck's G. Willikers, you're not going to hear very much. That was obvious. But the SWR wasn't horrendous. It was like 2.5 to 1. But, you know, for transistorized rig, that's pretty horrendous. So, okay, fine. I'm just not going to be working the world on my, you know, with my 35 watts on 432. Okay, fine. So I break out a three-element Yagi, and it's one of those handheld 218 or 418 megahertz things that Tony put me on to, which I had cut for 442 for FM. Lo and behold, I just threw it up on the rig, and in my ham shack, I was hearing auroral distorted signals. I was hearing primary signals from Connecticut and other places. Couldn't work anything except maybe Charlie, but was literally in my ham shack on the third floor of my house. I was doing really, really well. So, compared to what I had been with my other antennas. So, you know, advice is keep your feed system simple. Make sure everything really works before it goes up and blah, 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 blah. But the other thing I learned was that you guys have seen my orange box where the rig hangs from the top. Well, normally I operate in a vertical mode. The radio is operated with the box sitting on the floor or on a table vertically, and you kind of just peer over the side, and the radio stamped it toward you very nicely. When you lay the radio on your desk, the heat from that radio sits right where the radio is, no place to dissipate. Now, that wasn't a problem. I wasn't exactly reporting radio all weekend, so I wasn't generating 100 watts of heat or something, or 50 watts of heat continuously. But what it did say to me was that the radio would be better placed against the other lip, not the top lip, the bottom lip. And just for good measure, it would be a lot more comfortable to tune that knob. I got to tell you, I was getting cramps holding my wrist up that high, and I should have known better. I mean, I'm a bit of a human factors freak, and I get really obsessive over hand motions and ease of use and symmetry and all that good stuff, and duplicating interfaces for commonality. Man, this thing was a horror show to use, I got to tell you. So, again, we're going to refine that orange box a bit and put the radio on the other side of the box, so the top side is going to be on the bottom side. So that'll solve that problem. In any case, those are my lessons. Heat, operational capability, and comfort, which was key. That was really what annoyed me. That's when I noticed the heat, by the way. And the last, of course, is making sure you got your antennas all squared away. Yeah, that was painful, lesson to relearn for me on 432, no less. So anyway, all is good. And Charlie was bragging, by the way, rubbing it in that he was hearing at working stations in Delaware. Comments, questions, confusions, they are yours. K2BAR.
Comment?
Gotcha.
One of the little things that I've made for myself over the years, many times, is like a little 1x2 block, yeah, strip of just softwood. Doesn't make much difference what it is, scraps. Could be 6 inches, could be whatever, foot long, whatever suits your purpose. But just keep a few of those hanging around, and they they make great little spacers. You know, put the radio up on, get a little air underneath them, maybe get the angle up so it's a little more comfortable. You know, to accommodate a lot of the things you're talking about. And the other thing that keeps them from sliding around is you can get this anti-skid stuff, drawer liner material, whatever. It's you know, just foamed mesh that has a very high you know, skid resistance, and that tends to help things from sliding around quite so much. Use that in the car, on the boat, and sometimes dealt with under the foot pedal. You know, could be any number of things. The stuff is cheap. Don't care if it gets dirty or tires out or whatever. Anyway, very handy little thing. And that's 2K, all very cheap.
Yeah, W2TTT, absolutely. Well, yeah, the problem in this case, Jim, was the radio was hanging from the top side. If I had the radio as a mount on the bottom side, it would have been actually perfect. And if actually it was on the desk, just without the box, it has a bale underneath. It's actually really well positioned, nicely cut, nice, comfortable. But it's funny you should say about the wood. I actually keep scraps of wood on the third floor of my house, so when I redo, you know, the station from time to time, I have little pieces of wood that, not a whole ton of it, just a little bit. A couple of pieces of shelving and a closet, and then a couple of various spaced out pieces of wood, just for the wood you're talking about. In fact, my Pro 3 and my 46 Pro are mounted like on a, I think a 14-inch piece of wood or 15-inch piece of wood that's also pitched up, and it sits on my desk. It slides out from underneath the shelf. In fact, the front quarter of the radio is actually forward of the shelf is for cooling purposes. But, boy, it's pitched up at an angle in addition to its feet, just for that reason that you described, to make it more comfortable to operate. And I spent quite a bit of time deciding what that angle is going to be, and, you know, where, you know, how much, you know, how much to put on, take off. I played with that for quite a bit of time before I actually started screwing things down. So that's good. Human factors matters. Anybody else? K2BAR. I'll call that on here, W2JEK tonight. A lot of guys are away this week. Alrighty. Anything else from anybody before I go on to another subject? Okie doke. Oh, here's an announcement. I'm looking for people who might be interested in being part of a venture crew committee to sponsor a venture crew. For those of you who know what scouting is and know the exploring program, venturing is, they redesigned exploring to have two components. The part that we're looking at pursuing would be to have a ham radio group for youth, to provide some of our, shall we say, insurance for them, and also a context in which to have them operate as a youth-driven group. But it's my feeling that we need to have more youth. So rather than form a new club or whatever, just, you know, or have a particular club do it, I just figure I'd solicit people who might be interested in being instructors to teach ham radio or to act as mentors, etc. That might be a good thing. You know, you have the usual Boy Scouts of America requirements, you know, to be in that kind of environment, but fundamentally it's a good thing, and it would get our young men and women involved in ham radio in their teenage years, and maybe give them some additional skills where they can apply it, you know, maybe some first aid and some, you know, emergency preparedness kind of mindset, the kinds of things we like to encourage. So that's pretty much what we're going to do, and so I'm looking to put together a committee of people who might be willing to do that.
K2GCL repeater.
You need not respond on the air, although if you have questions, you're more than welcome to. But either call me or email me at w2ttt@adelworld.net or w2ttt@ttt.net, and we can discuss it further Of course, if you have any email from me from ever, you probably have my phone number as well, and you're more than welcome to call it from the time the net ends till, or, you know, maybe midnight. And give me some time tomorrow, please, but, you know, welcome to call me during the day or during the evening as you see fit. Be happy to discuss it, but that is proceeding. We want to get that going. We want to have it going before fuel day. I realize that Barra has their own fuel day, but, you know, we need to get like a fuel day where the kids get involved. And our Boy Scout troop does that every year, but we also need, I think, maybe to cast the net a little wider. So, if you're so inclined to participate in that in any capacity, let me know. Anybody else have any questions, comments, or confusion on the subject, please call K2BAR. Okey-doke. Anything else people would like to bring up at this time, please call K2BAR. Well, if there are no check-ins and no further questions, I have no further announcements other than to remind everybody that the there are two things a week from Saturday, a week from Sunday, pardon me, May 1, 2, 3, I think that is, 4th, May 4th, May 4th, Sunday. We have a Barra meeting that night at 7 p.m. We gather at the Red Cross building in Ridgewood on Godwin Avenue, and the meeting starts at 7:45. The club always has a good program. Either Steve or Bruce come up with a really great program, and I think we have one for this month as well. And then, of course, I believe there's the 1070 auction coming up the first Wednesday of May as well in Paramus. And then what else? Oh, and the transmitter hunt is also May 4th. That will be, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's noon. I'm the Fox, so I need to kind of know that. But May 4th is the, at noon is going to be the transmitter hunt. And I can assure you that it will be in a civilized location, but that it may not quite meet the 3-mile limit from, Westwood, you know, high school. But it will be convenient to all. I'm not going to have you driving to Oakland or something horrendous like that, or, you know, Mahwah, where the Ford plant was. I don't think we're not going there, but it'll be much more convenient. But for some of you, actually, it'll be more convenient than Westwood High School. I'll just leave it at that. If you also can find the 450 Fox, there'll be a 440 Fox as well. We'll come up with some bonus for you, some extra kudos. So, but the primary Fox will be on 2 meters, and we'll go from there. But if you could also DF on 440, there'll be a second Fox. You'll be able to, if location, figure out the other one as well, and you're more than welcome to do so. So, on that note, any other questions, comments, confusions, please call K2BAR. K2RIW, Dick. Wow, the master, K2RIW, I'm honored. K2BAR, Gordon here, how are you, Dick?
Very good, Gordon. It's about time I finally meet you on your net. I think you've met me on mine on a couple of occasions. If you had some time, I've got a slightly unusual electronic puzzle with reference to antennas that I could ask you and your group. The main reason for the puzzle is it does teach what I think is an important principle. How are you, Gordon?
Well, Dick, I would be honored to hear your puzzle, especially if it's instructional. We're kind of, shall we say, question challenge tonight. This is the first time where we've gotten to 9:30 and really had to kind of, you know, do that. A couple of times that's happened, and we end up talking to midnight. But tonight we're a little dry on the pump. And by the way, I believe, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, that this is our 1-year anniversary. So congratulations to all for their support for the year. It's been kind of fun. And we started 53 weeks ago. And we started, it was 52 weeks ago. It was our 53rd session of the net, plus or minus a holiday. So that's pretty cool. So, Dick, it's all yours, K2RW, K2BAR.
Very fine, Gordon. Before I proceed, there's two different power levels I can run this rig at. One of them, it's very reliable at, and the other one, sometimes it gets a little bit cranky. 90. So this is a high power level, and you tell me how well it sounds. I'm about to give a brief transmission on the lower power level, and you tell me how well it sounds at your machine. This is a lower power level now. Am I getting noisy, Gordon? Go ahead.
It's a bit of egg fry when you get that lower power level, but if it's more reliable, go to it.
Okay. Normally I run full duplex, but for a bunch of reasons I'm not doing that tonight because that particular antenna is of need of repair. Okay. This is an antenna puzzle. It teaches an interesting principle, and an awful lot of people have trouble answering it, even antenna people. Okay. What we've got is a pure dipole in free space. Electronically, it's exactly a half wavelength long. Its center impedance is 72 ohms. That's given information. So it's in free space, no ground nearby, no multipath. Dipole, which presents an impedance of 72 ohms and no reactance. So it's perfectly resonant, just the right length. 72 ohm dipole being fed with 72 ohm twin lead. And that twin lead is being fed with a transmitter that's got a balanced output of 72 ohms. It's got the right kind of a balancing device and whatever. So we've got an ideal situation. 72 ohm output transmitter, 72 ohm twin lead going into a 72 ohm antenna. And the antenna has been running steady state. This is not a transient condition. Let me drop. And this is a, call it a computer-generated animation, if you like, or call it an ideal instrumentation situation. There's continuous sine waves coming out of the transmitter. By some means, you've got a way of visualizing the situation, and you can slow down time. You can watch the individual sine waves come out of the transmitter, go down the feed line, and go into the antenna. So of the zillions of sine waves that are coming out of your transmitter, assume that the antenna is running at one megacycle, so once every microsecond there's another sine wave coming out of the transmitter. And you choose one of those sine waves coming out of the transmitter, and you decide to watch it. By some means, that particular sine wave coming out of the transmitter, you painted it with red paint. So you're watching the red single sine wave, 360 degrees of waveform. You're watching that particular one come out of the transmitter. You watch it go down the feed line, that particular sine wave, you're ignoring all the others. It reaches the end of the transmission line, and it gets, and it's about to enter the dipole itself. And you're watching that particular sine wave, and you're ignoring all the others. As I said, this is a steady state transmitter situation. It's been running for a long time, but you're watching that particular sine wave with your slow motion camera. As that sine wave, let me call it the 1 millionth sine wave, we'll call it, the one that's painted red, you watch it enter the antenna. Tell me what happens next. W2TTT, K2LIW.
Oh, man, I don't know. And, okay, so it has traveled down. I guess if there was a perfect match at every stage, then it should just transition onto the wire and into the ether just fine. But somehow I think there's a trick to this game that we're playing here. I'm going to defer to my panel of Jims first and see what they say. K2ZO and then NS2K. You want to take a crack at Dick's challenge? I wondered. Okay. Anybody else? Well, Nick, no one seems to want to take the challenge. I mean, you have a transmitter at C72 ohms. You have an antenna feed point at C72 ohms. I'm assuming that the length of the transmission line is such that there's no goofiness in that coupling, because you're saying everything is perfectly squared away. So, where's the object lesson? There's one in here somewhere.
K2GCL repeater.
Yeah, that's okay. We're going to assume that the transmission line is nearly lossless, perfectly matched on both the transmitting end and the receiving end, the antenna end. Many people think that the wave sine wave number 1 million, the one I painted red. It enters the wire of the dipole and just simply jumps from there into space. If this was an ideal computer-generated animation, slow-motion movie, and you watch that particular red sine wave, what would happen as it enters the actual wire of the dipole? What does it do? And I'll warn you that none of the respected antenna engineering handbooks, whether it be Krauss's book on antennas or the R.C. Johnson Antenna Engineering Handbook, or that's the third edition, the fourth edition, I can't think of the guy's name right now, but very good books. Don't explain this. Don't put it into language. Well, they'll give you a whole bunch of formulas which try to simulate the way an antenna acts. But that doesn't give you a warm, fuzzy feeling as to what's really happening. I'll warn you that the electrons of that wave do not leave the antenna. Not one single electron leaves the antenna. So that particular wave, wave number 1 million, the one that you painted red, it's going to do something on the antenna. The energy of it, yes, eventually is going to end up in space. That's going to be radiated as your signal that you transmit through the ether. But what does that wave on the wire itself do? And believe it or not, if you think back, we've all got a lot of clues. In other words, we've measured a number of things when we tune a dipole. We've seen a number of things happen. And somehow in our mind, we've never put all the information together. We've got all the clues. Every one of us has touched it, seen it, felt it, so to speak, but never quite realized what's really happening. Maybe that helps a little bit. I know it's a little bit left of center. But as I said, it is an educational process when you finally hear the answer. Back to you, Gordon, and maybe you can coax one of your guys into trying. There's no embarrassment of being wrong on this one, because as I said, good antenna engineers, people with 25 years of experience, have trouble with this one. I posed this particular puzzle in Philadelphia last September at the, 15th annual microwave update. Chose a number of smart guys there. Dr. Tom Williams, WA1 MBA, among others. Having trouble thinking of the guy's name right now. The guy who did the contacts on 241 gigahertz. Brian Justin, WA1 ZMS. I posed it to him. I posed it to some of my buddies. One or two of them had some of the information. And once you've got this little piece of information that I'm talking about, once you understand what happens to that particular sine wave, it'll make a lot more of the clues you've seen in the past sort of come together and you say, wow, why hasn't someone told me that before? So I'll pass it back to you guys one more time, or two more times. It's up to you, Gordon. K2RIW.
I'm getting a theory in my head here that actually might work, but MS2K jumped in just as you jumped in, so I want to give it to him and maybe somebody else. Jim, go ahead, MS2K, K2BAR.
Certainly far from a real answer, but I can make a couple of observations that I'll pose as possibly correct. At the junction of the transmission line to the dipole, you should find a current node at the ends of the dipole. I should think you'd find a voltage node where there obviously can be diminishing to zero current. There's no place for it to go. Exactly the mechanism by which the piece of wire or the signal on the wire couples to the ether is something of a pretty good mystery, at least in most of our minds. I suspect there has to be some kind of either magnetic in the case of current or electrostatic in the case of the voltage, higher voltage areas, coupling to what I'll call the ether, NS2K.
Yeah, that's pretty much where I was going. Basically, the key you said, Dick, was the electrons never leave, so therefore there must be, you know, as Jim eloquently placed, magnetic or electrostatic influences caused by the excitation of those electrons in a particular frequency, in this case, 1 megahertz. Anybody else want to take a whack at it, please call K2BAR.
K2BAR, November 2 ICO, one guess.
Okay, N2 ICO, your name, sir?
Handle is Kevin, the call is November 2, India and Charlie, Lima. I'm guessing that it acts like a transformer.
Oh, I think you are on to something, you and Jim both. Very good. All right, anybody else? W2JK. W2JK is wondering about you. Go ahead, Don.
Okay, I didn't get in quite at the beginning of this, but I do know that, you know, there's some kind of an induction kind of a thing there. You say that the energy does not leave the wire. However, if you think about it, if you put a antenna like the one you're transmitting from, you would see the power in that antenna, or that antenna could be many miles away, but the fact is that there is an induction where it excites the ionosphere for distant communications. If you think about a flashlight bulb, the electrons in that don't escape out of the little bulb of the flashlight, but the beam of energy is going out to light up the object you're shining a flashlight at. So there's a lot of angles to it. I do know that lightning, for example, a couple miles away, will induce, uses the word, voltage. And thus, if there's voltage, I guess there's going to be current also into your antenna quite a distance away. I've had it with the Windham antenna years ago, where lightning over 2 miles away caused the neon bulb to light. So that was, you know, 90 volts or whatever it takes to light one of those things. So, yeah, there's something there. Back to that W2JK.
I'm hearing transformer. That's what I'm hearing. Good job, guys. I think we're on the track. Anybody else?
K2BAR from W2KBF.
Wow, everybody's climbing out of the woodwork. Carl, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Gordon. It's a balanced transmission line. So while one side of the cable is sucking electrical field, the other one's pushing, if you get my drift. And they're equal and opposite, so you're not getting radiation from the line. But when you go into the antenna itself, where the wires are pointing in opposite directions, they're going to be, you know, let's say a positive electron flow on one side and the negative on the other. So, you know, you're going to get that separation, but you're not going to get the neutralization of the electrical field anymore once the current goes from the wire to the antenna. This is W2KBF.
It's all true. Excellent. All these observations. Anything else from anybody? K2BAR. Okay. Mr. Dick, it's back to you. Go for it, K2RAW. Really thrilled that you came in tonight. K2BAR.
Okay, nice piece of information by Jim, Kevin, Don, and Carl. Jim did say a node in the center and peak at the end. There may be a little bit of confusion there. I think the word node usually means a lack of something, a point where the current goes to zero, so to speak. But I can tell by the way he's speaking, he had it right. I'm not quite sure the vocabulary was right. The current is maximum in the center. The current goes to zero at the tips. And if you plotted current versus position, it is a cosine function. With cosine, you know, maximum in the center and zero at the tip. You can easily plot the current along the dipole. That's what I'm trying to say. Current, maximum in the center, minimum at the tip, and voltage the opposite. Voltage, you could call it a sine function, where the length along the dipole is the magnitude of what you see and you could make that into 0 to 90 degrees of sine for 0 to a quarter wavelength along the wire. So almost everyone knows what the voltage along the wire is, what the current along the wire is, and that current flowing is the mechanism used by many of the computer modeling programs. Those computer modeling programs will take your antenna and break it up into a whole lot of infinitesimal little pieces, calculate the current that flows through each piece. As the current flows through that piece, it generates some kind of energy that jumps out into space. The program will take your point in space that you care about, whether it be a foot away or a mile away, and it adds up all of those infinitesimal currents in a vector manner. That's the way the program works. And that gives you a little bit more of a feel for what's happening. When Don was talking about a lightning strike, which is a, let me drop,
K2GCL repeater.
That's an electromagnetic pulse, an EMP, the extremely high current that flows in a lightning bolt. A typical lightning bolt is 11,000 amperes and lasts for roughly 20 microseconds. And what you think is one strike typically is 3, 4, or 5 individual strokes. Now, this is after the leader stroke takes place. I'm just talking about the main visual and sound generating event. 11,000 amperes is a typical one. There's some super ones that will hit well above 100,000 amperes for, again, something like 20 microseconds. That makes an intense magnetic field that they call it EMP because it will couple voltage into any piece of wire nearby, and you can get megavolts across the piece of wire. And if it's connected to your radio, it can do damage if it doesn't have all kinds of protection. Where Carl was talking about the current being pulled from one half of the dipole and pumped into the other half, and it's taking place by way of the twin lead transmission line, the 72-ohm balanced line in this example. He's exactly right. I call that the pumping function. With modern-day circuitry, you could build a transmitter that is infinitesimally small, and it's located right at the center of your dipole. That transmitter, whether it be located right at the center of the dipole and pull current out of the left side and pump it into the right side during the first half cycle and the opposite on the other half cycle, you can see, sort of get a feel for what's going on. The nice thing about a balanced dipole is it carries its own counterpoise with it. You probably heard me give the example a few times of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Assume he weighs 200 pounds, he's floating free in the cargo hold of the space shuttle, and he's got a 200-pound barbell in his hands. He pushes the barbell 1 foot per second to the north, and action and reaction, Newton's third law, he starts moving 1 foot per second to the south. Action and reaction. So when you pull current out of the left side of your dipole, you're pouring it into the right-hand side. So the transmitter is a kind of a pump, and the transmitter can be located right at the center of the dipole, or if you've got a good feed line, it can be located a good distance away, but it acts like it's there. So pumping action takes place. When we call it a transformer, let me drop. The transformer action is there, but that's only in what's called the reactive near field. Depending on the distance from your antenna, the frequency you're on, the size of your antenna, they recognize three distinct distances. The main distance, the so-called far field region, mathematically it's called 2d squared over lambda, where d is either the length or the diameter of your antenna if it's a dish. So 2d squared divided by your wavelength, that is the far field region. At that distance and further away, you can measure the gain, the pattern, you can measure everything about the antenna. It obeys all the laws. It'll follow the law of inverse square law. Every time you double the distance, you get one quarter of the amount of power out of your receiving antenna. So that's the far field region. Inside of that, you've got a near field region where if you're closer than the 2d squared over lambda, if you're closer than the near field distance, funny things start happening. The pattern changes when you sweep the antenna in azimuth and elevation. You don't get the right pattern. It doesn't follow the inverse square law. It starts following inverse third, fourth, and fifth law. In other words, as you get closer, the signal gets stronger, faster than you think it would. And as you get even closer than that, they have something they call the reactive near field. In other words, your receiving antenna is so close to the transmitting antenna that you're getting direct capacitive coupling and direct magnetic coupling. That's the real transformer action. And up close, without a doubt, there is transformer action. But in the far field, there is no real transformer action per se. The antenna does, by some magic which we haven't discussed yet, it launches an EM, electromagnetic wave. An electromagnetic wave, once it gets out into space and gets free and gets properly formed, if it's a horizontally polarized wave, it's got E field that's horizontal, it's got H field, in other words, magnetic field that's vertical. At every instant in space, at every instant of time, they're always exactly at right angles to each other. It's a planar wave when you're in the far field coming away from that antenna. And believe it or not, the E field and the H field are in time sequence. Let me drop. In other words, at the instant that the E field is maximum at the point where you're measuring, at that exact same instant, the H field is maximum. A quarter of a cycle later, the E field goes through zero, the H field goes through zero at that position as this wave propagates to your point of observation. And it's kind of hard to believe that they both go to zero and yet propagation is still taking place. In the case of a parallel circuit, a resonant circuit, an LC circuit, the energy is bouncing back and forth between the coil and the capacitor. When the voltage is maximum on the capacitor, that's when the current through the inductor is going through zero. There's no magnetic field in the current in the inductor. Quarter of a cycle later, you've got maximum current in the inductor, but the voltage on the capacitor is going through zero. So in an LC network, energy is flowing back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor. A free space wave doesn't do that. It's got this other peculiar characteristic where everything's in time sequence. So these are more and more clues as to what's going on, but still, that red wave, many people think it simply goes down the wire once, gets stronger and stronger in voltage as it goes down the wire, lower and lower in current, reaches the end of the wire where you put the egg insulators at the far end, and then it has no other place to go. It flips around because it's a high impedance point. It doesn't reverse the polarity. It flips around and comes back. Comes back toward the feed point at the center where the twin lead is. After it has gone down the wire once and come back toward the center, what's your guess as to what happens next? There's still more to the story, believe it or not. W2TTT, K2RIW. My name is Dick. Gordon, did I drop out?
Sorry, step away for a second.
We're good.
Alrighty. That was pretty cool. That was very, very cool. So, let us go to the next step. You said there's essentially not quite a transformer effect, but there's some excitation going on, and then what? What is that next step, Dick?
Yeah, I'll jump down to the bottom line. Go ahead. We probably stretched this one long enough. That red sine wave, the million sine wave that in the slow motion animation movie, I'm watching it. I watch that sine wave go down the dipole wire. It gets to the egg insulator at the end, and it comes back. And it comes back toward the center. Because that wire on the left side and the right side, each side is a quarter wavelength long. It's a quarter wavelength in time, a quarter of a cycle in time to get down to the end, another quarter wave in time to come back. By then, the next wave coming out of the transmitter, out of the feed line, is a half wave later, is exactly opposite. If I was watching the positive 1 volt peak as that wave went down, it came back. When that positive 1 volt peak got slowly dissipated a little bit, and it came back, by then the transmitter is putting out minus 1 volt. It sees nearly a short circuit. If the voltage going down and coming back was exactly equal in magnitude and didn't get dissipated, 1 volt going out, 1 volt coming back, hitting one minus 1 volt coming out of the transmitter would be a perfect short circuit, and you can do that. You can put shielding around your dipole. In other words, you can make the dipole out of two pieces of RG8 coax cable if you wanted to, and just cut two little holes in the center where you bring the twin lead in, and the open circuit is on the far end. Now you've got a dipole inside of the shielding of your transmission line, and it doesn't have the ability to radiate. It's a quarter wave open circuit stub to the right, quarter wave open circuit stub to the left. An open circuit stub gives you a nearly perfect short circuit at the frequency where it's a quarter wave length long. So if you could stop the radiation from taking place, the wave going out and coming back is almost identical in magnitude. You'd have almost a perfect short circuit.
your input impedance to that shielded dipole would be nearly 0 ohms, not 72. Correspondingly, if all of the wave got radiated when it went down the wire and there was nothing left for it to reflect at the far end and come back, the input impedance you would see of the dipole would be many thousands of ohms. So if all the energy got dissipated, you'd see an input impedance of thousands of ohms. If none of the energy was allowed to radiate, to jump into space by some means, which we haven't described yet, then you would see 0 ohms. The 72 ohms you see is sort of halfway, logarithmically speaking, or geometrically speaking, halfway between those extremes of short circuit and thousands of ohms. That gives you a clue that the majority of what goes down and comes back is attempting to be a short circuit, but it got a little bit weaker. The bottom line of all this, that's never said in any of the books, let me drop.
K2GCL repeater.
The bottom line is that that red wave, the one that you're watching, and you're ignoring all the others, has to bounce back and forth on that dipole roughly 20 times before it has been significantly dissipated. It's an exponential decay function. You could write an infinite series describing it. It's a 1 over voltage square type thing on each individual bounce. But anyhow, it gets a little bit weaker on each bounce, and there's roughly 20 bounces. What we call resonance is to make sure that all those bounces stay in step. If the dipole was made a little bit short for the frequency you're feeding it, the signal would come back a little bit leading in phase. And we call that capacitive reactance. What's really happening is the voltage has to bounce back and forth roughly 20 times before it's finally radiated. The dipole has a Q of roughly 20. You've got another clue. If you've ever used an antenna analyzer on an antenna and you swept it, and if your antenna analyzer will tell you the reactive component and the resistive component, or if you look at the right graph in the ARL antenna book or any of the other good books on the subject, you'll find out that as you sweep in frequency, the reactive component moves very fast. Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook has one graph for the resistive component, one graph for the reactive component. As you sweep the antenna in frequency, the resistive component changes very slowly and monotonically, make the dipole a little bit short, and you get a little bit less than 72 ohms for the resistive component. But make the dipole a little bit short, and you get a huge capacitive reactance real fast. So the reactive component moves fast, the resistive component moves slow as you sweep it in frequency. That's the clue. That tells you that there's a signal bouncing back and forth, and if it all stays in step on each bounce, we call it a purely resistive antenna, has no reactive component, we call it resonance. Almost every antenna you and I have ever used, except for a rhombic and a beverage, you resonate first, then you have the ability to radiate. You can't radiate without resonating, unless the antenna is lots and lots of wavelengths long, like a rhombic. A rhombic is a traveling wave antenna. The signal goes down there once, hits a 600 ohm resistor at the far end, and dies. And you get unidirectional radiation out of that. Remove that 600 ohm resistor, all of a sudden you've got a lousy front-to-back ratio on your rhombic. But every other antenna we use is a standing wave structure. It's a high vis one. Even though the feed line on your dipole, let me drop, 72 ohm impedance, 72 ohm twin lead, 72 ohm transmitter, 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. No reflected energy on the transmission line. The signal, that red wave, goes down the transmission line once and never comes back on the transmission line. But it suddenly turns the corner, gets onto the wire of the dipole, and now it's got to bounce back and forth 20 times before it's down to probably 1 over E or something like that. It's an exponential decay. It's sort of like ringing a bell. The bell, if you've got a sensor on a microphone, it never completely stops ringing, if you know what I mean. But it gets weaker and weaker, and pretty soon you can say, hey, I don't hear it anymore. It doesn't matter. It's only academic. That's what's happening to your red wave. So when you want to understand, most of the antennas we've used, 99% of all the antennas we use, are standing wave structures. That means somewhere in the antenna, the signal is bouncing back and forth 20 times. When you make the antenna too short by making it a so-called infinitesimal dipole, you can force it into resonance by having a good impedance matching network, an antenna tuner. You can zigzag the antenna. You can put in loading coils in the center. You can put on top hat capacitors at the end. You can force it to re-resonate electronically when it's short. But when you do that, the number of bounces increases considerably. The Q of the antenna goes up. The reactive component moves faster versus frequency. The antenna becomes more and more narrowband. As long as it resonates, you can still radiate 99% of your power. A short antenna that's resonant, and as long as you built it out of lossless materials, is still capable of having the same gain. That's a hard one to believe. An extremely small dipole, re-resonated, only loses 4/10 of a dB of gain. 2.14 dB for a full dipole, 1.76 is the dB of gain you get for an infinitesimal dipole, if you're smart enough to build it out of lossless materials and resonate it. And therefore, it has nearly the same effective capture area. It's all those extra bounces and all that resonance that gives it that area. It's kind of hard to believe that a very, very small dipole has almost the same area, electronically speaking, effective capture area, as a full half-wave dipole. I think you guys have had enough. Back to you, Gordon. KQLIW.
Okay. That's interesting. Very good. Thank you, Dick. That was very good. Anybody have any questions or comments for Dick? And then I'm going to make mine, I guess. this is KQVAR. Okie doke. Right, so the key point is you can make a slightly capacitively reactive antenna and have wonderful gain as long as you keep your materials in line, as it were. It'll still be resonant. Interesting. Interesting. I'm still trying to catch one small point. So, how do we couple the dipole element itself? Is it analogous to, if you will, half of a transformer, if you will? Would that be, if I take two dipoles in space, and are they, you would say, analogous to an air cord transformer?
The answer to that, Gordon, in my opinion, is absolutely yes, if and only if they're so closely mounted that they're in the reactive near field of each other, way inside of the 2D squared over lambda, then yes, they are air coil transformers, and they couple quite well. And I've done a bunch of experiments with super close dipoles. And no matter what you do, you can't get all the energy to go from the primary winding to the secondary winding, so to speak. You still lose about 3 or 4 dB, and there's a bunch of explanations as to why that goes on. But yes, when they're close. But when you're in the far field, your 80-meter dipole is a quarter mile away from your buddy's 80-meter dipole. No, transformer action is not the primary action. I won't say it's not happening. Transformer action falls off with either 1 over square law or 1 over cube law. And I've seen two different articles on that one. It falls off and becomes very secondary, tertiary, or whatever. The primary coupling between two dipoles a mile apart is electromagnetic wave, that E and H wave that by some magic is launched by that antenna. This bouncing wave, another way I put it, is that radiation is hard. It is very difficult to make RF radiation. You have to kick that signal in the tail 20 times in a row on a full half-wave dipole at resonance, perfectly impedance match. You have to kick that signal 20 times in a row before enough of the energy leaves that you and I call it efficient radiation. It doesn't happen on the first pass. That's why it's called a standing wave structure. It's not a traveling wave structure. Only a rhombic or a beverage can do that. And even they don't run at super high efficiency. A significant amount of the energy ends up in the 600-ohm resistor at the end. But you put the 600-ohm resistor to get a good front-to-back ratio on it. And you still get a moderately good, you get a very good pattern as long as you've made it big enough. The pattern is where the gain is coming from, not efficiency. Whereas a well-fed half-wave dipole can easily have 99.9% efficiency. You can make the dipole super short, make it to 10% of the normal length, and it it's now highly reactive. It's got thousands of ohms of capacitive reactance. But if you're smart enough to make a low-loss antenna tuner, an impedance matching device, and you can put the antenna tuner anywhere you like, the efficient place is usually to put it at the antenna. You can force resonance to happen. But the radiating system consists of the antenna, the transmission line, the antenna tuner if you're using it, and the final tank circuit of the transmitter. It is that radiating system that you resonate. Dipole, feed line, antenna tuner, tank of the transmitter. That system you resonate.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, reset. No alpha, hotel, please. K2GCL, repeater.
We missed about the last 15 seconds of that, maybe a little bit.
I'm going.
Yeah, we missed the last 15 seconds of that. Sorry about that.
Yeah, you resonate that radiating system. The final tank of the transmitter, the antenna tuner if you use one, the transmission line, and the antenna. That's the radiating system. You have to resonate that whole system. You don't have to resonate the antenna itself. If the antenna was one-tenth of its normal length, this dipole, it's got an input impedance that's a few thousand ohms capacitive and probably 5 ohms resistive, a really terrible combination. But if your antenna tuner's got enough range to it, you can resonate that beautifully, and you can make that a 98% efficiency radiating system. Just that now, because the wire, the length of wire that the signal is traveling down is so much shorter, its ability to convert the energy on the wire into an electromagnetic wave in space is so much diminished that now the signal has to bounce back and forth 100 times instead of 20 times before it's resonating, before it's radiated. That's the reason why the antenna is very narrow in bandwidth. We call it high in Q, because now the only way the signal can be radiated is to be bouncing 100 times, in my example. Now your antenna has to be a lot sharper in resonance to keep the 100 bounces all in step with each other. That's the mechanism by which it becomes narrow band or gets reactive super fast when you start sweeping in frequency. So an antenna that's highly reactive doesn't stop it from radiating. It just usually raises the Q, something fierce, and it means your antenna tuner has to work a lot harder. And if the antenna tuner is in the shack, that means the signal is bouncing back and forth on the feed line a lot more times, and if the feed line is not low in loss, you're going to lose some power there on the feed line after all those bounces. So make the feed line low enough in loss, and the antenna tuner in the shack can work beautifully to give you high efficiency. The thing I haven't yet explained, because it ain't clear in my mind yet, is, let me drop, how the signal, the current flowing back and forth on the antenna, really creates that EH electromagnetic wave in free space. Not one single electron leaves that dipole. The energy of those electrons become dissipated as they bounce back and forth, as that wave on the dipole bounces back and forth. But by some magic, it gets launched into space, and the signal in space, to me, is still a little bit of a mystery. I listened to the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 15 and 16, and in between Earth and Moon, there was nothing but a hard vacuum. Not one single electron left that antenna on the Moon, went through that vacuum of space, and got arrived at my antenna in Farmingdale, Long Island. Yeah, photons moved through space. They moved through the ether. Maybe they're corpuscles, or whatever you want to call them. We've got great names for it. What is a photon? Now, we can call it an electromagnetic wave. It conveys energy, but it doesn't contain electrons. By some magic, it's got an electrostatic field. It's got an E field. It's got an H field. I mean, I can take two plates of a capacitor. I can put a battery across them. I can see more electrons on one plate, less electrons on the other plate. Let me drop. And between those two plates, I can figure out what is the volts per meter. There's a real E field between those plates. I've launched it by putting voltage on those plates. That's the way I can make an E field in anybody's laboratory. In free space, those metal plates are not there. That battery is not there. But yet the E field is still there. But there are no electrons creating that E field. In the case of the capacitor where I've got an electrostatic field that I can create in space, I can make it a dynamic one by putting sine wave on there, or a steady state one by putting a battery. I see the electrons, I see the metal plate, I see the E field, I can measure it. How in the world, without the metal plates, without the battery, how am I launching that wave into space? that last little step, not clear in my mind, and one of these days, one of these technicians is going to figure it all out, Gordon. Kept you guys long enough. KQRIW.
Thank you for doing this. This is, number one, just, you know, it's the start of our second year, so, you know, as I've said to you many times, that the idea and the pattern, albeit a poor, cheap copy in many ways, so we don't have the quite the same bent you do, has been your net, and I'm glad to, with a lot of help from a number of operators, half the people here tonight, at least, plus a few who aren't, to make it happen. So we've been very, very blessed with that, with the last year, to be able to have a TechNet. We got one station, I think it was KC2, okay, MLT was it, I'm trying to remember. He came in last night to the ChatNet to report on his success from implementing an antenna that we gave him some ideas on for his apartment. And he was all excited because he had made 20-meter contacts here, there, and everywhere. So it was a really good feeling. So that happened last night with respect to last Thursday's TechNet. In any case, I would like to, again, thank you, Dick, for being our mentor, our inspiration. And it's added a lot, you know, what you do for the Limark repeater on 14685 at, 8 o'clock on Sunday night. We've tried to, in some small way, implement here for our membership on Thursday nights and for our non-members as well, too. We get all sorts of people checking in. In any case, we had 19 of us tonight all chiming in, which is kind of cool. Anybody else have any comments for the for Dick or for the net, please call K2BAR. W2JK. Good, Don.
Yeah, I remember in one of my English radio antenna books, I'm looking through Les Moxon's high-frequency antennas for all locations, and I'm not sure if it's in here or a couple of the other books that I have. It describes that one Englishman had a long wire antenna that was about 2,000 feet long, and he walked along this antenna with a fluorescent tube attached to a pole, cable pole or something, and of course with the transmitter on, the fluorescent light was on near the set where it was fed. But as he walked further and further away, toward the antenna, I guess there were vault, but there was finally it was no illumination at all. He got to the end of the antenna. I guess you have to figure something that long. There's also ohmic losses involved in this too. That, you know, what you send down there, even though there's nice number 12 gauge wire or whatever, there's some kind of ohmic losses and something like that that figures into there too, that maybe they don't usually figure in. They require that the fluorescent tube didn't light down near the end of the antenna. Would you think it should if it was everything was way you expect it to be? Back in that, W2JK.
I don't want to get busy on radiation resistance and antenna efficiency, but you're hitting on a topic that's absolutely true. You know, there are people who say, I'm going to put up a stainless steel antenna. Well, okay, you can do that, but ohmic losses do kick in there. and have effects at various frequencies. And every reason they have an effect, but, you know, become more profound at various frequencies. Blah, 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 blah. I'm not going to go there. Anyway, Dick, thank you again. I hope everybody can join us for next week's net and all the other baronets on usually of Monday nights on some frequency, 28-350 Monday, 441 or 443-100 on Tuesday, 146-79 on Wednesday, and of course 146-79 again on Thursday. And tonight is also going to resume next week. Now school will be back in session, so if you want to go to Westwood High School, 7 o'clock I believe it is, Westwood High School, and that's always a good thing. And Don, your next test session is when? W2JK, K2BAR.
Next test session will be at the Ham Fest on May 31st from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock in the morning.
Most excellent. And I think there's also a party you guys going up to the Middletown, New York Ham Fest this weekend. I think some guys are meeting at Tony's house at 7. And I think, I know now I'm going at ODAR 30. I'm heading up, I think Richard, you said you would want to go with me. You're welcome to do so. We'll square up on the arrangements. But I have an inside table and I'm going to put it to work. And what else? I think that's about it. So have fun this weekend. And any last comments for the net, please call K2BAR.
K2GCL, repeater.
K2RIW.
Go ahead, Dick. Thank you again.
Yeah, when Don explained the 1,000-foot-long piece of 12-gauge wire with the fluorescent light tube, that is a slightly more modern version of a electrowire-like system. Most likely there was a little bit of a standing wave where the light lit, tactically brighter and dimmer as you walked along the wire, and then got dimmer and dimmer, of course, as the energy got dissipated. And yeah, the resistance of the wire is part of it. The wire is close enough to ground that he could walk under it, so some of the energy was being coupled into the earth. That was another one of the dissipations. We'll discuss this more at a later time. Good information. Bye-bye for now, you guys.
Okie doke. I don't know if anyone's figured this out yet, but I started the net in our church parking lot because I just dropped somebody off after a scouting, if you will, scouting parent mentoring trip to one of the local camping equipment stores. And so we had an unforeseen event at the end of our purchase that was about 15 minutes behind the eight ball. So I took the check-ins from St. John's parking lot and concluded the net, run the majority of the net, actually, after the check-ins and the initial question from Charlie W2R from my driveway. I haven't been out yet, so my 11-year-old is my only unlicensed family member, and he's working on it. I will give him credit for that. He just opened the window, and he's trying to suggest that I get my tail in the house and call it a day. So anyway, I think it's funny. All righty. Well, Dick, thank you again for your hospitality and your mentoring. And guys, I want to thank you guys for supporting them for this year and for kicking off the next year as well. 19 check-ins, one form or another, is pretty cool. Tony, K2FAZ, if you're still in there, we'll work with you in the next few days and get your dipole tweaked up. That's not a problem. Thank you, everyone, for a beautiful evening and certainly a memorable one. So this is K2BAR, W2TTT, Gordon signing clear, returning the repeater to normal amateur use, and thanking the Bergen County FM Association, whose membership we encourage, for the use of their repeaters. Good night, gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen.